I guess we'll begin as soon as we all get seated. We were in verse 9, where Paul had turned his attention to the sisters, and he called upon them, for Timothy to instruct them, to wear modest clothing. And we talked about what modest is, having to do with decent, what is appropriate, orderly, well-arranged. I'm not going to say that cleanliness is next to godliness, but that thought is not altogether wrong. An ordered life will reflect order in various areas, clothing included. Now, as to the point of God wanting us to wear what is appropriate, that's the big question, isn't it? What constitutes appropriate? And who says? And based on what? And when we get into this question, it's real easy to start jumping into what we all think. And I'm not going to be able to entirely avoid that, so I'll tell you up front. I'm going to do my best to keep this biblical, but there will be an opinion here and there probably as I try to apply what I see in the Bible, and we all must make those judgments before God ourselves. I don't want to legislate where the Lord has not legislated, but there are some things we need to consider, and Paul says in verse 9 that the sisters should accompany their outer clothing with some inner qualities. And the first of those qualities, he says, is propriety. Now I want us to note, Paul relates disposition to dress, attitude to attire, character to clothing. The two are not divorced from each other. They are tied to each other. What we do with these hands and our bodies is a reflection of what is in our heart. Now, there are certainly occasions where we may mistakenly do something and accidentally misrepresent ourselves. But as a general rule, what we do, say, and even how we dress is a reflection of what is in our heart. So Paul says, let this be in her heart. Propriety. Propriety. This word, and I know I'm doing a lot of defining of words, but I guess I feel like I need to, because when I read the word propriety, I'm like, okay, just what exactly is that talking about? The King James says shamefacedness, and you're like, propriety, shamefacedness, I don't know what to do with that. Other translations say modestly, others say decency. It just kind of seems like it's all over the map. I am not a Greek scholar. I have the benefit of having the work of some scholars at home. Here is what I have found. At first, the definitions do kind of seem to be all over the map. Strong says this word means bashfulness, as in bashfulness towards men. Hence the shamefacedness. Thayer says it means a sense of shame or modesty. Another modern resource says the term expresses the opposite of considering or treating it something in a common ordinary matter. It speaks to a respect for convention, which you're like, I don't know what to do with that. The source I found most useful is a work called Synonyms of the New Testament by R.C. Trench. If you like word studies and want to like a little extra than just this tiny little short definition that we get, which has to be incomplete and potentially misleading in Strong's and so forth, I'd recommend it. It's a work that was done years ago. It was intended originally for people who knew the Greek, but it's been updated for people who don't know it. R.C. Trench, what he did was he looks at all this ancient, the way the word was used outside of the Bible and other sources, even brings in other languages that had similar words and how the two interrelate, and kind of gives us a more rounded view of what a word meant to the people in the time. Here is what he says about this word. It has been understood as the shame or sense of honor that hinders one from doing an unworthy act, and you think, shame, sense of honor. Well, those two go together. If someone were to do something just outrageous that you know they knew was wrong, was completely inappropriate, it's indecent, what might we say? Have you no shame? What do we mean? Have you no honor? Have you no decency? That's the idea behind this word. Having that sense of decency, that sense of shame that hinders you from doing something that's inappropriate. It is a certain fear of justifiable blame. That is, fearing doing something that people could justifiably say, this is not right, this is not appropriate. It implies a moral repugnance to the performance of dishonorable acts. So the short and long of it is, this speaks to an attitude that says, I don't want to do anything that is dishonorable, that is inappropriate, that would put me in a position of being blameworthy. I feel very strongly that I don't want to put myself in that position. So it's a form of conscientiousness. Now, this other word that my New King James translates moderation, that the King James calls sobriety, so we've got propriety and sobriety. This word's a little easier. It just speaks to soundness of mind, self-control, good judgment, moderation. So that means our clothing choices need to reflect good judgment. Not excessive use of funds, not excessive exposure of body, not excessive elaborate clothing such that it draws unnecessary and inappropriate attention. This is the idea, that the way we dress ought to reflect that we are people of good judgment and self-control. All right. So with these two attitudes, a strong desire to avoid anything that would be dishonorable and make me blameworthy, and with self-control and sound judgment, with these two inner qualities, let a woman dress herself modestly. Now he goes on to say, in verse 9, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 3, Peter says something very similar. Do not let your adornment be outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Now I'm not reading the next part of the verse, which clarifies, I think, his meaning. Some have taken the position over the years that Paul and Peter are giving us an outright prohibition. That it is wrong for women to braid their hair in the respect that he's speaking of here, for them to wear gold and pearls and expensive clothing and so forth. I do not think that is what Paul is teaching. And the reason I don't is because of a couple of things. Number one, I look through the Bible and I see that God has spoken of things like this in positive contexts. For example, Proverbs 31, verses 21 and 22, when the virtuous wife is being extolled, it says of her that her household is clothed with scarlet. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Well, John, the idea there is that she just takes care of her family very well, and these things are being used to express an idea. Okay, maybe so. But let's go to Ezekiel 16, starting in verse 10. Well, I guess we could just turn there, because I was going to read a kind of a long chunk. Ezekiel chapter 16, you might recall, God talks about raising up the nation of Israel. How he found her like a baby and raised her up and she became this mature woman, and how he began to bestow blessings upon her, and he likens those blessings to clothing and other things. Ezekiel 16, starting in verse 10, notice the language that God uses to describe his own blessings. Ezekiel 16, starting in verse 10. I clothed you in embroidered cloth and gave you sandals of badger skin. I clothed you with fine linen and covered you with silk. Now these are not inexpensive things. Verse 11. I adorned you with ornaments, put bracelets on your wrists and a chain on your neck. And I put a jewel in your nose, earrings in your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. Thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your clothing was of fine linen, silk, and embroidered cloth. You ate pastry of fine flour, honey, and oil. You were exceedingly beautiful and succeeded to royalty. God speaks of His blessings as the sort of thing that's mentioned here in 1 Timothy 2. Furthermore, in the Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 9, notice what Solomon says to his wife. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. I love the way you look in a necklace, is what he's saying. Would God prohibit things that he speaks of in this way? I think that's worth considering. But furthermore, just because the Bible says don't, you have to look at the full context, and this is not going to sound as out there as it sounds right now. Sometimes do not is certainly absolute. Matthew chapter 5, 34 through 36, Jesus said, do not swear at all. And let me clarify that. Neither by heaven, nor by the earth, neither by Jerusalem, nor shall you swear by your head. You shall not swear at all. It's an outright prohibition, period. But, Jesus says in John 6, 27, do not labor for the food which perishes. Really? What did Paul say? If a man will not work, what? Neither shall he eat. Jesus said, do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life. What's Jesus mean? It's about emphasis, isn't it? It's about which is the most important. Don't make the first the emphasis. Make the second the emphasis. And the first is something you just got to do while you're doing the other. The same thing in 1 Corinthians 1:17, a favorite passage of some of our religious friends. Paul said, "For Christ did not send me to baptize." And they'll say, "See, John? Baptism is not important. Paul was not sent to baptize." Paul said, "Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel." Well, what's the point? Well, my first priority is not getting people wet. My job is to preach the gospel, and should they receive it, then I'll get around to the secondary thing. Did Paul baptize people? Absolutely. In that very congregation, in that very chapter, he says, "I baptized these people, and I may have baptized some others. Oh yeah, and I baptized this one." Christ didn't send me to baptize? So we understand that the statement is meant in the sense of emphasis. And we know that because of what it says. Don't do this, but do this other. The exact same thing exists here. Paul says in verse 9, "Not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works." That's the adornment. Now you might wear some of these other things. That does need to be done in moderation and in a modest way. But the emphasis is going to be the good works. That's the thing that's going to beautify you. Go over to 1 Peter 3 with me for a moment, if you would. Peter does the exact same thing over there. Peter, 1 Peter chapter 3, starting in verse 3. "Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel." And by the way, that "merely" has been added. It really should read this way. "Do not let your adornment be outward." Sounds just exclusive right at the first. "Arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves." That is, Paul's just simply saying, sisters, let your true adornment, let the jewelry you emphasize be your godly lifestyle, your good works, your gentle and quiet spirit. If the emphasis is not to be on the other. I don't take it to be an exclusive statement. I would like to say more than a couple things here. The world in which Peter and Paul wrote these statements was not altogether undifferent from our own. David Burcott, in his book, "Will the Real Heretics Please Stand Up?" A book I'd recommend, by the way. It's not very thick, and it's terribly interesting. He goes through writings that were done in second, third, maybe even early fourth centuries by proclaimed Christians and the way they applied the Scriptures. And he contrasts that with doctrine that is popular in the evangelical world today. And of course, it shoots all kinds of holes in it, among which they believed in baptism for the remission of sins, which the evangelical world scorns. So it's an interesting read. He writes in his book the following about the subject we're talking about. "A fashionable Roman woman used virtually every beauty aid that her modern-day counterpart uses. She began the day by arranging her hair and putting on her makeup. She painted her lips, applied black eyeshadow, put on false eyelashes, coated her face with white powder, and smoothed rouge onto her cheeks. She wore her hair in an elaborate hairdo, complete with curls, bangs, and ornate layers of braids." And if you've ever seen any of those Roman busts of a woman, you see that. Very ornate hairdos. "Roman women adorned the rest of their bodies as much as their faces. When going out, they would array themselves with jewels, often wearing expensive rings on every finger. Fashionable women insisted on wearing gowns made of imported materials such as silk." And he goes on to say, as an aside here, "Even many Roman men wore cosmetics and dressed as lavishly as the women." What are we seeing in our day? What is it in the 21st century? The metrosexual? The man who behaves and dresses in an generally considered feminine way. Those lines are being blurred. We just follow the same things over and over again. Why do I bring up all that? Because in the first century you have a world where people are going over the top. Where it is all about clothing. Let's wear expensive rings on every finger. Let's be noticed for the way we dress. And Peter and Paul are saying, that's not the way a Christian woman approaches her clothing. The church, Burcott tells us, in those later centuries discouraged the use of cosmetics. They exhorted men and women to be content with simple clothing. Now, we're not going to base our doctrine on what they did, but I think that's interesting. Tom Woody, some of you heard me tell this story, maybe most of you. In 95, Tom and I ran into each other out at J Street. And prior to that, I mean, I remember being here 21 years ago, the meeting of 93. That was a highlight of my youth. Wonderful time here. And I had a kind of a ridiculous hairdo at that point in my life. And I had cut all that mop off, and Tom saw me at J Street, and he just said to me, John, I like your hairdo, your haircut. I don't notice it. And it was nice. It was nicely said. And I think there is something to that. I can't be noticed for who I am if what I'm wearing is shouting so loud. And brothers and sisters alike, although for sisters in general it's going to be more of a concern, this has to be taken into account. Clothing that doesn't draw inappropriate attention to itself is what we're looking for. Something that allows attention to be drawn to the woman. And sisters, isn't that what you want anyway? You want to be appreciated for who you are, not the way you look. There's one other aspect of this I would like to talk about, and I wish I'd been able to talk about, and this is not a critical statement at all, I just kind of wish I'd been able to talk about this with the class downstairs up here, because some of this is old hat for you. And it might be something new to them. But hopefully I can share it with you. And if you think there's truth in it, please share it with your children and grandchildren. When it comes to wearing what's appropriate, we're not only thinking about expense and so forth, but we're of course thinking about what covers the body. The Bible does talk about a thing called nakedness. And what does God call nakedness? What is it in the marriage bed, it's fine. In a medicinal environment, it's fine. But in general, what is nakedness? It's shame, sin, yes. Revelation 3:18, Jesus said to Laodicea, I counsel you. Now, he's speaking spiritually here, but the thoughts are still the same. I counsel you to buy from me white garments that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed. Same thing in Revelation 16:15. Behold, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. It's a striking thing when we're told about Adam and Eve that they were naked and were not ashamed. Because since Genesis 3, that's never been the case. Unless your heart has been hardened or you've been indoctrinated from youth to believe a lie. Nakedness is shameful, and we know it. But the big question, of course, is what constitutes nakedness? What constitutes nakedness? I mean, is God only outlawing entire nudity? I don't think any of us believe that. So the question is, how much clothing is necessary? And we don't want to answer that with our ideas. If there is an answer to that question, God gives us, we're going to have to find it in God's revelation. And so let's see what indications the Bible gives us. Genesis chapter 3. Let's go over there for a moment. I feel a little sheepish about talking about this because I remember teaching it 9 years ago at the 2-week meeting, but it's been 9 years. So I'm kind of hoping I can we've got a new generation, but they're not here. So I'll revisit with all of you. Genesis chapter 3, verse 7. Adam and Eve have eaten of the fruit. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings, or as the King James says, aprons. Adam and Eve, when they realized they were naked, inherently, innately, naturally, they knew that some of their body needed to be covered. And so they covered their private parts. That's what this word is speaking to. A girdle, a belt, something that covers just the middle parts. Nothing else. As you know, later on in the third chapter in verse 21, after God has dealt with the sin and announced the consequences, it says, and also for Adam and his wife, the Lord God made tunics of skin and clothed them. Now they had made clothing for themselves. Why does God give them clothing? Well, apparently what they've made for themselves is not satisfactory. The word here for tunics, or as the King James says, coats, I'll just read to you what the authorities say it means. Gesenius says it refers to a garment that is generally with sleeves coming down to the knees. Wilson's Old Testament Word Studies, covering from the shoulder to the knee. Brown Driver Briggs, a tunic, an undergarment, a long shirt-like garment, usually of linen. A History of Jewish Costume says it was a shirt-like garment with long or short sleeves and came down below the knees. It is the word used for Joseph's coat of many colors. And numerous other sources would tell you what I just read. Now, I don't want to legislate where God has not legislated, but I think this is interesting, and it is at the very least worth considering, that they made for themselves coverings that covered their generative parts, and God came along and gave them coats of skin. He may have killed an animal to clothe them this way. The very first thing that ever died in this world may have been to make coverings for their shame. And he covered them, it appears, in a garment that stretched from here to about the knee. Exodus chapter 20, verse 26. We have another piece of information that might be useful. Exodus chapter 20, that's the last verse in the chapter. Moses is talking about how they should build their altars. Exodus 20, verse 26. We'll start in verse 25. And if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone. For if you use your tool on it, you have profaned it. Nor shall you go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed on it. It was not unusual for altars to be made in that day where they would be raised. Of course, we're going to worship God or the gods. So we're going to raise this altar. You're going to have these steps up to the altar. God says, you're not going to do that with the altars you build for me. Don't build them with steps, otherwise what will happen? Your nakedness will be exposed. Now, those would have to be some pretty high steps, and we would have to be standing pretty close to the steps for us to see under a man's garment to what's considered nakedness today. That'd be pretty high steps, and you'd have to be pretty close. That's circumstantial evidence, but it's interesting. How you have to be pretty close to see up well past a man's knees. It makes me wonder. Exodus 28, verse 42, when the high priest's garments are described. In this case, an undergarment. Exodus 28, starting in verse 42. And you shall make for them linen trousers, or breeches, I believe the King James says. You shall make for them linen trousers to cover their nakedness. And they shall reach from the waist to the thighs. Okay, so these breeches, these undergarments are there for the purpose of covering the man's nakedness. And they're supposed to reach from the waist to the thighs. Now, if we take the expression to the thighs literally, how big is this garment going to be? It's not going to be any bigger than what Adam and Eve made. Maybe less. So, to the thighs must mean something other than how it would literally seem to mean. So what does it mean? Well, these are only the words of men, but these are not people with axes to grind. Hear what they say. In the pulpit commentary, that this means reaching from the waist to a little above the knee. James Strong, the one who did Strong's Concordance, he wrote a book called The Tabernacle of Israel. He wrote, they reached from the loins as far as the thighs, which must mean that they entirely covered both these parts. That is, they went to the knee and necessarily enough below this to fasten securely and comfortably. The Bible in Basic English, which is basically a commentary, it's the only translation I found that took any liberty at all with this passage, it says, from the middle to the knee. The only source I found of all that I consulted that with certainty disputed what I've just read to you was Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary. You've probably got it at home. It's pretty helpful in some ways. They said this, that this garment reached halfway down the thighs, but they based this opinion on Egyptian art. So, and they say that. So what am I saying? It appears that God clothed Eve and Adam with clothing that went from the neck to the knee. The priest, very possibly himself, wore garments intended to cover his nakedness that went from the waist to around the knee. I'm not going to legislate, but I think it's worth considering. I personally think this matches up with what we almost naturally understand. I mean, I think I can speak for nearly every man in the room. When a woman begins to show much above the knee, much, it draws the eye more. There's just something worth considering. If a woman wears too expensive clothing or too little clothing, she draws attention that she really doesn't want. And that's true of men as well. It's true of men as well. I will say one other thing. Brothers, is it possible to, and sisters as well, is it possible to reveal your nakedness without revealing skin? I don't think there's any question. Parents, brothers and sisters, would you, if you have children, and I don't know of any particulars here, so please don't think I'm saying this because I'm pointing this at you. If you've got girls who are wearing yoga pants, or you're wearing them, would you reconsider, please? Nothing's being left to the imagination. Nakedness is being revealed. It was at this very meeting house, I believe, years ago that Wilfred Landis took a sister aside and said to her in his memorable way, "Sister, you're not being fair to me." And, you know, modesty is not just about not creating temptation for the opposite sex. That's a secondary issue. The first issue is what God considers nakedness, if we can figure that out, and honoring that. But this is part of the package. Abel was supposed to be his brother, or Cain was supposed to be his brother's keeper. I have a responsibility of treating my sister with holiness. Paul's going to tell Timothy that in chapter 5. Treat your sisters with holiness, with purity. And the sisters have the responsibility to their brothers to not present a stumbling block before them. I've had young men tell me that they intentionally sat towards the front of the building during church because if they sat further back, they were struggling with what they saw. And this is not what the Lord wants. We can't be edified in an environment like that. So let's move on. Verse 11. We're going to jump from the frying pan into the fire. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. I have been grappling with this and 1 Corinthians 14 since I was about 19 years old. I met a man in college who was from a Church of Christ that uses one cup in their assembly for the Lord's table. And he had very, very strong views about what was appropriate for sisters in the assembly. And we went back and forth, back and forth. We went back and forth so much about issues related to this question that the Bible I had, that 1 Corinthians 11, around 11, 12, 13, 14, those pages you could just take out. So I'd gone back and forth so many times. And again, just because a fellow's thought about a thing a long time doesn't prove anything. I say that only because I've held positions on both sides of this question. And after looking at it, trying to figure out how to sensibly and consistently apply any given interpretation, I have landed on what I'm sharing with you this morning. I do think that this verse applies to the assembly. That seems to be the easiest and most sensible interpretation. Those who try to apply it to other contexts create really bizarre circumstances for themselves, I think. I think he's talking about the assembly. The men were to pray everywhere, focusing on men because it's public prayer. Now it's what the women are going to do publicly. And in the public assembly, he says they are to keep silence. And I do think this verse parallels nicely with 1 Corinthians 14:34. And if Mark's here, I'm going to finally use this thing. It seems to me that these verses just are almost identical. 1 Corinthians 14:34, let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive as the law also says. Here we read, let a woman learn in silence with all submission. At face, at first look, the only real difference is that 1 Corinthians 14 offers extra explanation. Let her keep silent in the church, for they're not permitted to speak. And they're to be submissive as the law also says. Now there is one other difference which we don't want to miss, but at face value, that's the only difference. I think they're speaking about the same context, and when put together you're going to come up with the same answer. Let's look at the word silence, because that's the question, isn't it? What does this mean? And we'll start with the word in 1 Corinthians 14, because the words are different. The word in 1 Corinthians 14 for keep silence. Keep silence is one word. It's the Greek word sigao. S-I-G-A-O. S-I-G-A-O. And here is what the Greek lexicon says about this word. It means to be silent, to say nothing, to keep still, to keep silent. And it cites two passages where it is used this way. If you want to turn with me to 1 Corinthians 14, let's look at them, because it's not just verse 34. 1 Corinthians 14. Remember how you had some chaos going on at Corinth. You had a lot of people wanting to participate, and apparently there was vying for attention and time in the assembly, and people maybe even talking over each other. So Paul says, all right, we need to impose some order. Let all things be done decently and in order. So, in verse 28, he says, if anyone speaks, pardon me, verse 28, if anyone, but if there is no interpreter, this is of people speaking in tongues, if there is no interpreter, when someone gets up to speak in another language, let him keep silent. That's this word, same word as in verse 34. Let him keep silent in the church, and let him speak to himself to God. So, he wants to share this revelation he's received from the Lord in another language, but Paul says, if there's no interpreter, let him what? Keep silent, which means what? Don't talk. Because there's no one to interpret what you have to say, don't talk. In verse 34, which we've already read, the same meaning, say nothing, keep still, keep silent. Now they have another meaning, they say, which applies to verse 30. In that case, and I don't know how they come up with these nuances, but they say in this case it means to stop speaking, become silent. In verse 30, notice what Paul says. Speaking of prophets, but if anything is revealed to another who sits by. So I'm up here and I'm offering my prophecy when suddenly another brother has a prophecy that he receives from the Lord and he's ready to talk. If that happens, let the first keep silent. Which again means what? I was talking, but now I'm to stop talking because he's going to talk. So when we come to chapter or verse 34, it means the same thing. We've had it used twice already. We know what it meant there. Why would it mean anything different in verse 34? This word is also used in Mark 14, verses 60 and 61, where we read the following. The high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" But he, that is Jesus, kept silent and answered nothing. Luke 19:40. But he answered and said to them, "I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out." At his triumphal entry, the people were crying, "Hosanna in the highest, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." And they say, "Do you hear what these people are saying?" And Jesus says, "If these don't say it, the stones will. If they keep silent, the stones won't." But even without a Greek definition, I think we can understand what the word means. Notice verse 34. Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak. If they are to be submissive. Verse 35. If they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home. Brother, I do think he's saying in the assembly, and let me define this, I do not personally believe that our Bible studies that we call classes are the assembly. The assembly in 1 Corinthians 14 is when the church comes together. That's what Paul said, when the church comes together. When we have our Bible studies on Sunday morning, the church has not come together. We are having concurrent Bible studies under the same roof, but the church is not together. Several sisters are downstairs teaching children. A brother's down here with a bunch of young Christians in the teen class. The church has not come together. These are concurrent Bible studies. We could just as easily be doing it in different buildings. We just happen to be doing it in the same building because it's convenient. The church, the assembly, is when we come together for the Lord's table and for the edification of the saints. That's what I believe. And in that context, the sisters are not even to ask questions. And generally speaking, we don't do that. I mean, we're already doing this for the most part. There are some instances in which I think we need to reconsider. I think announcements is kind of an iffy situation. We bring the whole congregation back together. The assembly now is in full swing, and the first thing we do in some places is open up the floor, and sometimes the sisters speak freely. And they're doing what they know, and I just think we need to consider, is this in harmony with what Paul's revealing here? Why is Paul doing this? Is this because the Lord does not appreciate what the sisters have to offer? Most certainly not. Most certainly not. You know, I was struggling with a passage here in 1 Timothy, just what is this talking about? And I, you know, was thinking and thinking and thinking, and then I was able to talk with Amber about it. It really helped. She makes me look way better than I am, I assure you. She is such a help to me. She's got such an exceptional mind. She thinks methodically. She looks at an angle, it looks like an issue from all angles, which I tend to want to hurry through something. Well, what about this? What about this? And she thinks of things that are outside the box. Oh, yeah. She has much to offer. The Lord is not saying that the sisters do not have anything to offer. But Paul says order needs to be imposed on the assembly. We can't let every prophet speak. Some on that particular Sunday are just going to have to not get to speak. Some tongue speakers, they might have something, but for order's sake, some of them just aren't going to get to. They have something to offer. It's from the Lord of all things. But on this particular Sunday, they're not going to get to offer it. We need order. And that's the side of the thing here. The Lord wants the men to be the leaders. This is going to be affirmed before this chapter is over. He wants to see them rise up and be teachers, competent leaders, not only in their family but in the church. And to help bring that about, He has asked that the sisters confine their offerings to more private settings, which we're going to get to. In the public assembly, not the classes. This is what I think he is saying. Let's look at the word silence here in 1 Timothy 2 now, because it is a different word. Even though it's translated the same way in my New King James, some of you probably have translations that instead of saying silence in 1 Timothy 2, say quietness or something along those lines. The word here, if you would like to write it down, is E-S-U-C-H-I-A, or make it H-E-S, because it's got a hard breathing at the front. So H-E-S-U-C-H-I-A. You can call it Heisukia for communication purposes, whatever you want to call it. This word, says the Greek lexicon, as it is used in 2 Thessalonians 3:12, means a state of quietness without disturbance, quietness or rest. Let's quickly turn to 2 Thessalonians 3 so we can see what he's talking about. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 12. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 12. Now those who are such, that is the busybodies of the previous verse, those who are such we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness. That's this word. That they work in quietness and eat their own bread. Now we all know that a word, you can use the same word in totally different ways. I can jump off a train or I can jump on your case. Totally different things were meant, but I used the word jump. So the way what jump means in one sentence does not prove necessarily anything about what it means in another sentence. What a word means is always dictated by context. According to these men, and we can see where it makes sense, this word means quietness. You work in quietness. Undisturbed, you don't create trouble, living peaceably with all men. Work in quietness. Stop being a busybody, stop wandering around talking to everybody about everything. Work quietly. As it is used here in 1 Timothy 2, however, the same source says, it there means a state of saying nothing, or very little. Silence. Another source said the word is used in this sense of silence. This word appears in 1 Timothy 2, 11 and 12, which we're looking at right now. It appears in 2 Thessalonians, which we just looked at, and it appears only one other time in the whole Bible. And let's look at that one, Acts chapter 22. Acts chapter 22, and this event has already been referenced by Charles, I believe it was, when Paul is standing before the Sanhedrin. Is the Sanhedrin or people there? I can't remember. But I think it's the mob. Okay. He's standing before this group of people and defending himself. We're going to back up to chapter 21, verse 40. Acts chapter 21, verse 40. So when he had given Paul, permission, Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with his hand to the people, and when there was a great silence... Now remember the word in 1 Corinthians 14, 34? Sigao, S-I-G-A-O. That's the verb. This word is the noun, S-I-G-E. In your Strong's, it's right next to it. It's like a catcher is the noun, and what's a catcher do? He catches. There's the verb. So this is the noun form. When Paul started speaking, there was a great silence. He spoke to them in the Hebrew language, saying, chapter 22, Brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now. And when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. This word is the word in 1 Timothy 2. Notice the way it's used here in Acts. The word here in Acts that's used in 1 Timothy 2 is not less strong. It indicates a greater silence even. We've all seen a silent crowd. We've got one now. For the most part, there's no talking. You know, moms might be whispering to children or something like that. I don't think we're talking about that sort of thing. But no one's talking out loud except me. But there's quiet, and then there's when the hush comes over the crowd. And everyone just stops. And there's real stillness. That's the idea here. And the word used to convey that is the word that Paul uses in 1 Timothy 2. Now, he does say all the more silent, but it's interesting to notice the usage. So when I look at the way those verses parallel each other, when I look at what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 14, if you have a question, ask it at home of your husband. But John, what about sisters who aren't married? Good question. Paul is giving a general command. Most sisters of age are married. I mean, that would be true even here. If I were to ask for a show of hands, most sisters, say, over the age of 22 are married or have been married. In general, and especially probably in the first century, this was so. So Paul is giving a general rule. And certainly also, because the Lord wants His people to marry His people, most Christian women will have Christian husbands. So in most cases, a Christian sister will be able to speak to her husband in a private environment. It doesn't have to be at home. It could be at the restaurant. We're not being dogmatic about this, but the point is she's not to ask it there, not in the assembly. So since that is clear, to me anyway, since these verses do seem to parallel each other, I do think what Paul is teaching, one more time, is that in the assembly, when we're having the sermon, when we're having the Lord's table, sisters are to refrain from participating publicly in that environment, even to ask a question. Now, someone might say, well, yeah, but doesn't Paul say that when we sing, we're speaking to one another? In psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, I've heard this before. You're speaking there. You're saying that sisters aren't supposed to sing? Well, again, I cite the jump example. Jumping on your case and jumping on off the train are totally different things, even though it's the same word. I think that argument, and if anyone here has honestly considered that argument, then please excuse me, but that argument has always seemed like just a stretch to me. Because singing and speaking are just so obviously different things. They both use the mouth, and hence they're both speaking in that sense. But speaking to one another in psalms and speaking in the sense of asking question are obviously totally different things. And I think we need to honor that. I know this will probably almost certainly generate thoughts, and I want you to please feel free to challenge me and ask any question that you have. Let's finish out this verse, though. She is said to let a woman learn in silence with all submission. This word just means literally subjection, subordination. Just as she is under her husband at home, under his leadership, so also in the assembly, the leadership of the men is to be honored. And by leaving them to be the ones talking, that helps that. You know, nature will not tolerate a vacuum. So somebody's got to talk. And since the sisters have been asked to refrain, the men are going to have to stand up. And brothers, we need to do a good job. For sisters to have to sit there and listen to us and not be able to speak their mind, at least during the assembly. They have an outlet in our Bible studies and other venues, every other venue as far as I can see. But just in this one venue, for them to have to sit and listen to us, let's love them enough to give them something. And the brethren in general. Verse 12, same thing. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. I guess our time is up. Wait, I got 5 more minutes? Okay. 3? That's right, mine's 2 minutes behind. 4? Arguments and disputes over words. Okay. I do not permit a woman to teach in the assembly. This is not prohibiting sisters from teaching women. Let the older women teach the younger women. It's not prohibiting sisters from teaching their children. We need them to do it. Eunice did this with Timothy. The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. This is not a platitude. Sisters, the church desperately needs you to teach your children the Word of God. Now, your husband needs to be involved in that, making sure it's happening. But you spend more time with the small children than he will. They desperately need you. She is not in the assembly to teach or to have authority over a man. Now, I don't know if this have authority applies to the teaching or not. Some say yes, some say no. It is true that teaching does come with a type of authority. I teach at a nursing home once a week, and we recently had a lady start coming to the study who likes to talk a lot. And you know, people get older and they become more like themselves and they speak their mind. And she started talking too much, and one of the ladies sitting next to me, we have a teacher. Says to me, she'll take over if you let her. She'll take over. Isn't that interesting? It's understood that I'm leading the study. It's a form, a temporary form, but a form of leadership nonetheless. And so in the church, that's to be honored. One more quick thing, if you will. Notice how it does not say usurp authority. The King James translation said in 1 Timothy 2, verse 12, that a woman is not to usurp authority over a man. And much has been made of that. Other translations, in fact, I know of no translation that uses the word usurp except the King James Version and the Living Oracles of back in the mid-1800s that Alexander Campbell liked. All others that I'm aware of use something like what we're reading here, to have authority. The New American Standard, the English Standard Version say a woman is not to exercise authority. The New King James, the New International Version, the New Revised Standard Version all say have authority. The word means to exercise dominion or authority. So the point is not, as has been taught in the past, that if a man should give the floor to a sister, that she is then free to speak in the assembly since she's not then usurping authority. She's been given the authority to do that. That's not what Paul is saying. In the assembly, she is not to speak or to have authority. That work is for the brothers in that very limited, and of our entire lives, this, the assembly, and we're not in the assembly right now, we're having Bible studies. The assembly is a very limited amount of time. It's an hour each week. That's the only thing that I see Paul speaking to here, with some possible exceptions in smaller congregations. But we can talk more about that later if you'd like to. I appreciate your attention. You've got 10 minutes.